Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisbee.
I'm Kirsty Dill.
And this is a podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what have you been reading on time?
I've been reading what I think is definitely going to be one of my favourite books that I've read this year. As we approach the end of the year, we're starting to look back at everything we've read, or I'm starting to look back at everything I've read and started to slightly formulate my books of the year in my head, although I've still got a couple of months to go. This is going to be on that list in some position. Trespasses by Louise Kennedy, which was published by Bloomsbury earlier this year. It is set in the Troubles in Northern Ireland. It's set in the 70s predominantly, and it follows a woman called Kushla, who is 24. I'm having to do this from memory because I got it out of the library and had to give it back, so I can't check everything.
I think that's right.
Yeah. I think so. She's about 24, give or take. She lives with her mother, who drinks a lot most of the time and is quite a needy individual. She works behind the bar part of the time in her brother's pub. Her brother is called Eamon. They live in a small town that's sort of just outside Belfast. So they are not sort of right deep in the heart of the Troubles, but they're certainly proximate to it. They're a Catholic family. She's also a school teacher. And it's about the fact that chance and being in the wrong place at the wrong time can have completely devastating consequences. She is working in the bar one night when this older guy, I mean, by which I mean older than her, I think he's in his early 50s, comes in. His name's Michael Agnew, and he is a Protestant lawyer, solicitor, barrister. They end up having an affair, and that becomes, you know, a sort of thing that's going on at the same time as her getting involved with this family. There's a boy in her class, a wee boy who's about seven, called Davy, and his father has been attacked. They're a Catholic family who live in a Protestant area, and his father has been attacked walking down the street very, very severely, and has been in hospital, has very severe injuries. And Kushla has sort of taken Davy under her wing somewhat. So there's all this stuff. When I say it's a very traditional novel in terms of the way the prose is, the way the plot is laid out. You know, there is nothing tricksy about it. And in one sense, there is nothing that happens in the book that is extraordinary outside of the context of the Troubles. You know, violence and checkpoints and sectarianism. But the point is in that book that all of that is what they contend with on a daily basis. It's going through checkpoints, going in and out of Belfast itself. It's, you know, her male friend, Jerry, his name is another teacher at the school. They kind of pal about together. They sort of semi-pretend they're dating, and when they're not really, they go to a party together, and he gets sort of taken out the car by the British soldiers and sort of roughed up a bit. But all of these sort of everyday awfulness things sort of come to a head at a point, towards the end of the novel, where all of these small elements of chance and normality and being in the wrong place at the wrong time sort of coalesce into something devastating. In which a lot of people lose absolutely everything. And I think what is amazing about the book is, in many ways, it's very quiet. It's very understated. It is normal life, albeit in kind of extreme circumstances. But she does it with sort of such texture and such attention to detail, but the attention to the right details. You know, there's nothing extraneous in it, that actually it very quietly builds up to being really quite devastating. It's a debut novel, which I think is extraordinary. She's written short stories before, but this is her first novel. And I just think it's a real, real, brilliant novel. And also, I was interested in the Catholic Protestant stuff. I can't remember if I've said it on the podcast before. I come from what they call a mixed marriage, which is my mum was Protestant, my dad was Catholic, and that was controversial in some elements of certainly my father's Catholic family. He married a Protestant. So that sort of tension between Catholics and Protestants, not in the kind of macro sense, not in the sense of the kind of ideology behind the troubles and everything, but in the everyday way that, you know, they're sitting in the pub, because the pub is in an area that is not sort of right in the heart of the troubles, and you're just slightly outside Belfast. There's Catholic and Protestant, and they're all in there together. And there's this ostensible peace, but yet, you know, they're all avoiding certain subjects, and they're all a bit uncomfortable when stuff comes on the TV news. And, you know, there's points where, you know, they'll encounter each other outside in slightly more fraught circumstances, and they'll just sort of not reference the fact that they were drinking in the pub the night before. And I just think all of that sort of attention to detail was really, really beautifully handled. So yes, Trespasses, I thought, was quite brilliant. My only complaint about it is it's one of the many books at the moment on the cover where women do not have faces.
We can't blame Louise Kennedy for that, though.
No, and I am not blaming Louise Kennedy for that. There's just a lot of books at the moment where women don't have any faces. I find it quite irritating.
Now, I read this in the summer, and this is more your sort of book than mine, I would say, but I loved it so much, I read it cover to cover in a single day. I did not move off the sofa for most of the afternoon. Because I think the characters and the tensions between the characters are so well. I mean, you said it was quiet just then, and I'm like, was it though? Not sure it was. But
I think by quiet, I meant the kind of, it is rooted in the everyday. You know, there aren't these huge dramatic, there are moments of drama, certainly, but there aren't these massive dramatic set pieces where everyone's, you know, everything is just done so straightforwardly and in a way that felt like real life.
Mm. I'd agree with that. I think it's very tightly plotted, but in a really clever way. The other thing about it for me, which is totally just relevant to me, but I'm going to say it anyway, the place that it's set is Hollywood, which is where I lived when I did my master's degree at
Queen's. Oh, is it? I didn't know that.
Yes. So it's where Louise Kennedy grew up, which obviously it was quite different when I was there, but the MI5 buildings there, because I was there at the time when they put a taxi bomb outside it to try and blow it up. So this would have been, oh, when was it? 2010? I think sounds about right. And also the bits, one of the things that she did really well, I think, in terms of class tension is where Michael lived as well, because parts of Belfast are really middle class, like big gardens, big houses near the park, really lovely. And so she, where his flat is and what have you, she did that really well, with like difference between the different parts of the city. So I sort of got another layer out of it, I think. I don't pretend to like understand Northern Irish politics as well as people who have lived there and lived through it and what have you. But yeah, it was real. It just gave it another layer for me to read that.
So I really want to go and read her short stories now. I just think it was great. What about you? What have you been reading?
I have been reading The Skeleton Key by Erin Kelly. And if you're an Erin Kelly fan, which I am, there are bits of this that are familiar from, if you've read her debut, which is The Poison Tree, there are bits about this that'll seem familiar, but she's got to a point, I think this is like book 8 or 9, where she has absolutely perfected what she does. So it's got a bohemian, what I mean by it's like The Poison Tree is there's a bohemian family at the heart of it. There is also a song that she's using as a sort of basis for the story, so in The Poison Tree it's the William Blake poem. Anyhow, so what the book's about is this woman called Nell. She is, we mostly follow her, and she is going home to her family, who she's sort of semi-estranged from. So her family are rich. They're living in a really nice house. They're just off Hampstead Heath. And the house is so fucking fancy that basically her parents' best friends live next door, and there's a door that they can walk through to get into each other's side of the house. It's that sort of thing. And her family are really famous because her dad is a celebrated artist called Sir Frank Churcher. And 50 years earlier, her dad wrote a book called The Golden Bones. Now, Erin Kelly's based this on some book that came out in the 70s that she said she loved as a kid. Now, I'm almost the same age as Erin, but I don't remember this book at all. But I'm sure there's people who do. And I can't remember what it's called because I'd never heard of it before. But anyway, this is what she's based it on. So within this book, there was a treasure hunt set that was... So what they did was they put these bones, they weren't real bones, golden bones, tiny ones. They buried them around the country, and the clues as to where they were in this book. And when you put them back together, they created this woman called Eleanor who'd been murdered. So this was a sensation. This is pre-internet, obviously. So people like bonded together and went looking for the bits. And eventually they found all the parts of the body except the pelvic bone. Some people went a bit loopy over it all. And decided that the pelvic bone, because Nell's real name obviously is Eleanor, they decided that it was part of her. So you know really early on that she's been attacked in the street when she was a teenager, that they were going to try and kill her basically to get the bone out of her body.
Oh God.
Yeah. So that's why she doesn't have that much to do with her family. But also her dad's this like massively celebrated artist, but also like very much a white male celebrated artist, bit of a twat. And so what they do for the 50th anniversary is because this bone was never found, he's got it. He eventually took it out of wherever it was, kept it, and has decided for the 50th anniversary, they're going to launch an app. Her brother, Nell's brother, is a developer, so he sorted out this app that they're going to use. He's brought the pelvic bone out of hiding. They're going to they're going to reveal where it is. They're filming this sort of documentary about it and what have you. Anyhow, what happens is they go to get the bone out, and it turns out to be a real human bone, not the golden pelvic bone. They were tiny doll's pelvic bone they were expecting. So there's a dead body. Well, there's a dead pelvis that may or may not belong to somebody who is missing. They don't know. Nell's also got a kid in tow, a teenager. So her boyfriend has disappeared, is an addict, and she is looking after his teenage daughter. They've got issues with social services. She doesn't want Billy to be taken away from her. She feels that she's found a piece of family that she was missing. So there's all that going off as a sort of subplot, which I loved, because one of the things that Erin Kelly does really well in that is show that bond that you can have with a kid who's not biologically yours, which I'm sure I've talked about on here before, because I have a stepkid who's like, Dad, I'm not married to, and we still have a relationship. So it was really nice to see that in print. Anyway, it's a really interesting story. So it's got these two families, three of them are artists, one of them's a nurse. They're a bit wild. It goes back in time, so you see what was happening before. Trigger warnings for literally everything. I mean, you don't go to a psychological thriller, do you, thinking that it's not going to be, but like care system, grooming, what else have we got? Alcoholism, domestic abuse, like it all comes out at different points of the story. But the big thing for me was, considering how much I read, I did not see a single reveal or twist coming. Not one. Like, was surprised at every point about all the things that got revealed throughout the book. It's brilliant. It's really gripping. Really interesting. Like, they felt this. I still feel like they're hanging about. You know, when you've got those, Cussler and Michael in Trespassing. I feel like they're hanging out in my house.
Yeah.
Like, and I read it last week, but they're still here. I'm still thinking about it. So I don't really want them living in my house because most of them aren't very nice. Nell and Billy can move in, but the rest of them can fuck off. No, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I have not read any Erin Kelly. She's one of those authors that, well, you've raved about her multiple times to me. And lots of people I know whose opinion I respect are big fans of hers, but just circumstances have conspired to that I've never read anything by her. But I do have a proof actually of the skeleton key, because I managed to snaffle one at Harrogate Crime Festival as I name drop my publishing perks. So I do have a copy of this. Obviously I've not got around to reading it, don't be ridiculous, but that sounds amazing, and it does sound so completely up my street. And also, the biggest recommendation you could give me is that you said you saw absolutely nothing coming. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's why I have to have breaks from thrillers for a while. Like, I'm not one of those people that can read loads and loads and loads of thrillers in a row, as much as I love them, because I do get the fatigue of, like, is there a twist? Is there a reveal? Is it coming? Is it now? Is it going to be this? Is it you? I find that it can be a bit kind of, I can have enough of it, as much as I love them. But that makes me want to read it all the more. So perhaps I could even get to it this year. Who knows?
Well, talking of, like, thinking of books of the year, it's definitely going to be on mine. So,
even more praise. Mm. My goodness. Let's talk about a book that's not going to be on your list.
Can I get in? I fucking hated it before we even start.
Right.
Oh, man.
This will be a robust one, won't it? Right. Yep. So, the two books we are talking about this week are, oh dear, the poor book. The Falconer by Dana Chatnick, which was published by Faber in 2019. Naomi's not a fan. And the other one is We Go Around in the Night and Are Consumed by Fire, which certainly gets the award for longest book title, hereby known as We Go Around in the Night, by Jules Grant, which was published by Myriad in 2016. So we're starting with The Falconer. I don't feel quite as negatively about it as Naomi does. There were things that I didn't like about it and annoyed me about it, but I'm not quite at the hate, not at the hate level. So it's about a 17-year-old girl called Lucy who is in New York. She goes to a very fancy private school. She has her parents are well off. Her dad's a lawyer. Her mum is in sort of adjunct professor. But she feels quite sort of out of place with her extremely privileged classmates, who are, you know, she's privileged, but I mean, they're sort of a cut above. You know, her best friend is a guy called Percy who is going to Harvard basically because his dad is so wealthy that he's just offered a massive donation. So, of course, it's going to Harvard, essentially bought his place. You know, they're real proper, really rich people. And she, Lucy, is a basketball obsessed, sort of quite tomboyish. She wears men's Levi's and baggy t-shirts, and all she loves is basketball, and so doesn't feel that she fits in with the kind of super girly set around her. That's sort of it in terms of what it's about. It's not a particularly plot-driven book. It read to me like a sort of collections of musings on the nature of what it's like to be a girl in early 90s New York, except a very certain type of girl with a huge amount of privilege. And it sort of plot-wise didn't go anywhere else from that, which is one of the things that I found irritating. But why don't you tell us why you hate it?
Well, I was just going to say, because we chatted a little bit about the fact that it had no plot before, but I'm actually, the one bit of plot it does have, sorry, spoilers, she fancies Percy, she shags Percy, he ghosts her, then, you know, they reconcile a little bit.
That is, and you can see it coming a mile off, because Percy's her best friend, but she's got this massive unrequited crush on him and has done for years. And inevitably, they end up having sex, and inevitably, he ends up being an absolute wanker.
Well, because he is from the first fucking page of the book. He's horrible.
Yeah.
But the thing I really hated about it, and that sort of fits with that whole Percy trajectory as well, is that she does this big thing about gender. So this is really early on in the book. So she's talking about her love of basketball and what that means and how people ridicule for it. I'm a girl, I'm really tall, I don't have Pantene commercial hair, and I'm not, let's say, un petit fleur, so everyone just assumes I'm a lesbian. She talks about how rude people have been to her, even though, like, she says, what is it she says about Percy's, she compares herself with Percy because he's, like, really good at basketball, but she's, like, basically bloody amazing at basketball. Yeah. So there's all this, and she's got this big thing about, you know, the reason it's called the Falconer is because she likes this statue in Central Park that's of this boy and the way he's standing, and she's like, they never make statues like girls like that. So there's all this, like, really sort of feminist slant to it. And it's that time as well. I mean, none of this is in there, but it's the time of Riot Girls. And also, I was 17, about the same age. So partly my problem with this is that I was also a raving feminist, angry as fuck, and all the rest of it at that age. So the other thing that she does is she goes and babysits for some of the locals. Now, one of the annoying things we need to talk about when she goes babysitting is she fucking goes through everybody's stuff. She's outrageous. Don't trust her in your house. But she gets to the door of this woman that she babysits for, right? And she opens the door. And she says, she's got unruly wavy black hair speckled with wiry tufts of white, the nascent formation of jowls, soft shiny skin with fine crisscross lines around her cheeks and eyes like tidal patterns in sand. Normally she wears shapeless, boxy, monochromatic, glorified pyjamas or pleated khakis paired with a sweatshirt. Her face is actually younger than her appearance usually suggests, like she's looking forward to menopause so she'll have a legitimate excuse to stop trying. It's conceivable that she could be in her 30s at the right angle, and at a different angle, she could be in her 50s, which is to say she's most likely in her 40s. And that age, to me it seems, is some sort of a strange death knell for female beauty. Not that women lose their beauty at 40, but that seems to be the age when so many of them give up. They cut their hair short, put on 15 to 20 pounds, start wearing clothes from Eileen Fisher. But tonight, Janie Greer's got on a little-ish black dress that shows off the upper limits of cleave, which, unlike my mother's, doesn't have any wrinkles. And you know what? My only response to that is, fuck off. And also, I don't understand how you can have this character who's a raving feminist who complains about the way people judge her for her clothes, and she does exactly the same thing to all the women who are a little bit older than her in the book.
Oh, she's an awful character. She's an awful character. I don't know if that makes me hate the book or whether it just makes me hate her.
I think, apart from, we'll talk about them in a bit, apart from the two artists who, like, the stuff about art and creativity is interesting, but that's partly because I'm a writer, so of course I'm going to be interested in people talking about whether they should go commercial or not. Nothing about it, I think, interesting. There was nothing in there. So I think one of the things, I'm coming more and more around to the idea that I read mostly because I want to learn something, and I learn absolutely fucking nothing from reading this book. And there was nothing in there that felt new or interesting or taught me something I didn't know. Or
I think how I felt reading it was that it read like YA, by which I mean, not just that the protagonist is a 17-year-old, because I think you can have young protagonists without it being a YA novel. It felt to me like you know, feminism for beginners in a way. Do you know what I mean? Like, that, I mean, aside from the stuff that she says about people over 40, which I had a similar reaction, I have to say. It comes up, that time is sort of the worst, but it comes up again at another point. She kind of makes all the right noises about, yeah, for instance, like the Falconer statue. That's something I learned. I didn't know about that statue.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, saying it wasn't total washout on the learning front. But she makes a very good point about, you know, the, I've got the quote here somewhere. When she's talking about the statue, she says, "It's not of someone famous. It's just a boy at the height of his powers, standing on top of a mountain, commanding nature, releasing a bird into the wind without any fear." And she goes on to ask why there's no statues like that of girls. That's a, you know, that is an excellent point, and I completely agree with her. And I like the fact that she identifies with that statue. It kind of calls back to the way she thinks of herself when she's on the basketball pitch. Is it a pitch when it's basketball? It's a pitch, right? Field, court.
I don't do sport, Kirsty.
No, neither do I. Basketball's the tall one, isn't it? Yes. Right. Baseball's the one with the bats. So when she's on the basketball court, she talks about herself as this warrior goddess, you know, whereas, you know, when she's off the court, actually, she's this very insecure, very conflicted, very naive and very young teenage girl. So I like the fact that she associates with that statue, and I like the fact that she's asking why there's no statues of women. But she's, the ideas don't really get developed any further than that. And I think that's what I struggle with. It does feel like, I feel like it would be successful if you were of the same age reading Lucy and seeing yourself reflected in her and going, oh, well, you know, in a way that Lucy has various moments of revelation, particularly towards the end of the book, particularly when she's talking to the artists. You know, I can imagine another 17-year-old kind of going, oh, yes, no, I see what you mean. But as a 40-year-old who's clearly given up and lost their looks, I just sort of went, and? Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, and? I mean, they were funny. I mean, the bit I found funny when she's talking about Percy, I mean, Percy's just this horrendous character who, you know, refers to pussy and, you know, just treats girls like shit and has this, you know, kind of faux consciousness about the way that his family have earned their enormous wealth, which it transpires is from investing in the firm that made Agent Orange. And sort of, but he has this kind of faux rebellion where he graffitis bus stops, but he does it of like these philosophical quotes, but he does it in dry erase marker. Like that's just Percy all over. And I found that sort of image very funny. But yeah, I was about to say I'm waffling, and then I remembered no negative self-talk.
Good.
Thank you. I felt like there were some good individual scenes in the book. I thought there were individual scenes that were really well done. I really liked the bit where she's in the taxi on the way home from this party that's been horrendous, and she's been dressed up by one of these other girls in her year, like her someone's girlfriend, and she hates it, and she's wearing makeup, which she hates, and one of the guys that she's with, who's, you know, typical awful posho, is horrendous to the female taxi driver, who then kicks them out the cab and just takes Lucy home. And I really loved that scene of this taxi driver who's trying to connect with Lucy, and Lucy's just sort of oblivious to it, presumably because it's an older female. But the whole, for me, sort of, it all just ended up being a bit, yes, and.
Yeah, I did enjoy the taxi driver. Actually, you just reminded me that's like three pages that I enjoyed. So she was good. And I did actually like the bit when they made Lucy get dressed up, basically. And then, and I thought, oh, this is going to be, I thought that was going to be the bit when she had sex with Percy, because I'm like, she's going to like walk into the room and he don't pay her any attention whatsoever. And I quite enjoyed that, like, not doing the typical plain Jane makeover thing. Yeah, I have got to, just while you talk about Percy, this is the bit about Percy that just summed him up for me. So this is right near the end of the book, but in a spoiler. So she's walking through New York and she goes past the Shakespeare and Co, where James's dad took us all to see Toni Morrison read from Jazz last fall. And Percy lamented that he'd never get to see any of his literary heroes read because they were all dead. So I'm like, you were literally in a room with Toni Morrison and all you could do was whine about Walt fucking Whitman, who took his washing home to his mummy while writing about the living outdoors. Yes. Sums you up perfectly, my friend.
You know he likes Hemingway, don't you?
Oh, yeah. And weren't she going to give him a Milan Kundera book? And I was just like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to, in fact, one of the things I was thinking about when I was reading this is last series when we read Kirsten Arnott's Mostly Dead Things, mm-hmm. and we said we'd aged out of it, and I have very definitely aged a long way out of this because I am over 40 and past my beauty and intelligence, clearly, and whatever else.
You've and just you know given what? Up.
I prefer it here. Well, because the other thing that really pissed me off about all that is the thing, so spoilers again, but the big thing she finds out is everything she's basically believed about her parents and them like giving stuff up to look after her isn't true, that they willingly, because they wanted her and they willingly like changed jobs and whatever to make sure they had a happy, stable home life. And even when her mum tells her that, and her mum, so what her mum started off, it looked like she was going to be some bright young academic, and then she ends up, like you said, being an adjunct, so she teaches and she marks essays and stuff. And she literally has to say to Lucy, no, I like what I do. Like, I teach these students that I've given feedback and it's great. And as somebody who teaches, like, I liked her mum, her attitude to it all just pissed me off. And I was like, wait till you grow up, Lucy. Wait till you grow up.
Child. I mean, that's how I felt about Lucy as well. You know, she... And this was something that sort of I couldn't quite reconcile, is that you have this idea of Lucy as this very street smart, you know, she's more aware than her super posh classmates. You know, she talked, there's a point where there's a basketball match of this kind of private school against a local, much rougher public school. And they play rougher. Like, you know, she says, you know, the private school, you would call a foul as soon as look at someone, whereas this is much more physical and much more visceral. And yeah, there are blooded noses and all this sort of stuff, and it's just how you play the game. But on the other hand, she's completely oblivious. You know, she has this idea of feminism as women go out to work and they don't stay home and look after the, you know, it's a very simplistic idea of, you know, if you stay home with your children, or you change something for your children, or if you have children at all, somehow you are betraying the sisterhood, the ideals, you know. And that scene, which I thought was a really good scene with her mum, going, well, no, well, the reality was, for me to go to work, we ended up paying so much in childcare that we were actively losing money. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, that's still a problem today, God, more than ever. Trying, you know, it's that age where you're kind of, you are fired up and you're full of idealism. I mean, I was at 17, and particularly around feminism, of, you know, it's, you think you've got it all figured out and it's all very clear cut, and you do this and this is how you do this and this is how you do that. And her mum's trying to say, you know, life is not as simple as that, and there are different ways to live your life in a different way to exist. And as you say, I am happy doing what I am doing, and I am happy that I stayed home with you to that part of your life. And she just can't, she's just, it doesn't fit with her view of what feminism should be.
Well, also the artist, so Violet tells her a very similar thing, because Max has started to take off, and she started to take off. We only get sort of Violet's perspective on this, but partly she's started to take off because she's doing these outlandish like installations that she knows are playing to crack. She calls it something like slogan art, doesn't she? Lyra does, not Max. Some of it sounds a bit Tracy, I mean, and what have you. But Violet says to Lucy, Max thinks, so she's in this relationship, Violet is, with this guy who's also a dick. Like, why are all the men dicks? Find a decent man, for God's sake. But Violet talks about the fact that she wants to fall in love, she wants a relationship, she wants a family, she wants to have a like stable life. Mm. And Max thinks you can't have that and have art. And this has always been part of the problem with the whole like sort of artistic thing, is what artistic lifestyles should look like. And all that stuff about it being dramatic and all the rest of it is just bollocks. It doesn't produce good art, it just makes your life fucking unstable. Like, you can produce good art if you know you've got money coming in and you can feed everybody, and you know what I mean, and the person that you're in a relationship with isn't going to walk out at any given point. And so yeah, but she sort of that comes as a bit of a revelation to her as well, like, you know, oh shit, what?
Well, it's the room of one's own, isn't it? You know, women can write and create when they have the freedom and the financial stability to do so. You know, nuance aside, you know. It's funny that bit. I thought the artists, I think, were in some ways the most interesting characters, possibly because they weren't the posh ones. But I thought it was strange, like looking at the copy on the back of the book, it feels like this sort of relationship that she has with those artists is meant to be this really central seismic moment of the book. You know, so, you know, as Lucy questions accepted notions of success, bristling against her own hunger for male approval, she's drawn into the world of a pair of provocative artists living in what remains of New York's bohemia. And that feels like it reads that it's going to be this kind of the main thrust of the book, is she's drawn into this world. And actually it feels like it's something that happens quite towards the end, and sort of nothing really comes of it.
I would read that book that the copy's about.
Well, that's presumably why I bought it. But that wasn't that book.
No, it wasn't that book. But we keep coming back to this, don't we? Issues with copy. Like, I think this is the third time we've mentioned it. See, this is why. Who was I? I was talking to a friend yesterday, and she was on about what some book was about. And I said, I won't know. I said, because this is why I like getting proof copies really early on, is because, sorry, publicist, but I don't read your AI sheets. And I don't read, if there's anything printed on it, I don't read it. I'm just like, oh, let's see what this is about then. And I much prefer going in without having any expectations than thinking it's going to be about something and then being severely disappointed.
Oh dear.
Anyway, if anybody wants my copy, it's going to the charity shop.
Clearly lots of people have loved this book. It's had amazing coverage in the US. She's been very much backed by Salman Rushdie, who has not only given a quote from the book, but looking at the acknowledgements, has been very supportive of her career. So it comes much fated and much, and we certainly know someone that said they loved this book. So we apologise to you, David, when you listen to this podcast.
He's probably switched it off by this point.
Yeah, he switched it off as soon as he said you hated it.
He'll be tweeting me.
It made me feel very old.
See, it didn't make me feel old, it just made me feel angry. So clearly my 17-year-old feminist self is still very much there.
Whereas I've just given up. I'm just wilting in a corner. My life is over. I'm 40.
You've
my
got cleavage is wrinkly. Kirsty, you know. Can't be having two little kids in a life.
Anyway, let's move on to a book that we did very much enjoy. Mm-hmm. As mad as it is. So I'm going to say this very long title once more and then shorten it. We Go Around in the Night and Are Consumed by Fire by Jules Grant, which, as I said, published by Myriad in 2016. This is a rollicking tale of a female lesbian gang like that came out wrong.
Commas are good.
I know. Female, comma, lesbian gang called the Bronte Close Gang, who are part of Manchester's gangland scene, basically. They're affiliated with one larger gang. They're rivals with other gangs. There are, you know, the novel opens, well, first of all, with our main protagonist, Donna, having sex with a woman up against the bins. She's not hygienic. And then her and the gang go and kidnap a guy who is from a rival gang, and then they torture him a little bit. Someone wheeze on his face. Lovely. And then they dump him out of a car. Anyway, it's a hell of an opener, I have to tell you. There's Uzis, you know, there's machine guns. It's all going. Anyway, so Donna, she runs the gang along with Carla, who is a single parent to a 10-year-old girl called Aurora, and they essentially sort of running this empire on Manchester's streets. But this is not a spoiler because it's on the back cover. Quite early on in the book, Carla is gunned down and killed in a nightclub as part of gang rivalry to get back at her for something that she did. So the novel is really about Donna dealing with the aftermath of Carla's murder, of trying to look after Aurora, who is 10, but seems to be much older, has to be much older because her mum's in a gang, and her, as much as her mum adores her, her grandmother is a rampant alcoholic, and Aurora is the only one actually sort of in any way taking care of her, literally going in and cleaning up after her and trying to convince her to take Complan so she's getting some nutrition into her and all this sort of stuff, and constantly dogging school and what have you. So the novel is basically the intricate, the kind of intrigues around whether the Bronte Close gang are going to take revenge on the people that they know murdered Carla. It's about them finding out that people that are meant to be affiliated with them are involved and wants to kind of take back the area that the Brontes run. It's about Aurora as the daughter of a woman who has just been shot. It's about family. It's about found family. It's about the failures of the care system. It's about all the things to do with gangs that we talked about with the Khan last week around honour and loyalty and all that sort of stuff. But also it's just absolutely batshit.
It is, and I think if it hadn't been, there are lots of things in this that could have made it really dark and too much to read.
Yeah,
because lots of the things that I wrote down I wanted to talk about were like Aurora, she's 10 and she's running drugs for some lads. She's looking after a nan. She's dealing with her mum's death. She ends up, part of the book is her like trying to escape from authorities who are trying to take her into care, and she's not having it. And it could be really grim. It could be really grim. And bits of it are. I want to talk a little bit about Manchester and the setting in a bit. But yeah, and so the batshit bit sort of evened it out. Is that the word I want? Balanced it a bit for me. So there was all these bits that because they weren't really believable in terms of what it must actually be like to be in a gang and live that, so like they were fun sort of almost escapades,
yeah.
Part of them, and some of the sort of running around they did, and I very much enjoyed. So Donna's got this like what's like a sort of bunker almost built into the garage in her house, and the door to the bunker they nicked from Strangeways. So it's this massive, thick door to get in. And I properly enjoyed them talking about how they got it out of Strangeways and how they had like what they needed to carry it and stuff. That was very entertaining because I'm like, not in a fucking million years did that happen, but that is hilarious.
Oh, yeah, there's like motorcycle chases and people smashing chairs over each other's heads and yeah, like inter-lesbian bar rivalries, where they're all in Canal Street in Manchester, and there's different, I don't know, when they go to Liverpool and end up starting a fight with a gang of lesbians in Liverpool, and it's, you know, it's all kind of very madcap and sort of cartoonish in its violence, and then, you know, comes back to those more serious issues.
It reminds me, you know, when you mentioned, is it Bad Girls?
The prison drama.
Yeah, it reminded me of that.
Yeah, totally.
That sort of over-the-top soapy, almost.
Yeah.
Thing. But there are serious bits in here, and one of the bits that I really want to talk about. So one of the things I loved about it is, obviously, I spend a fair bit of time in Manchester, which we've talked about right since the beginning of this podcast, and also one of the bits she talks about the roads, she talks about driving, going out on the motorbikes on the A57, which is the road that comes out to Sheffield. And when I used to go to fucking loads of gigs and used to drive to Manchester and back, because you couldn't get a train back after a gig at that time, I used to drive on the road that she is talking about, past where they lived. So parts of this, like I was saying about trespassers earlier, part of what I enjoyed about this was picturing where they were and knowing the places. However, she has a really important thing to say about where they're from. So she's talking about Gorton, which is part of Manchester that most people, if you're not from Manchester, you probably aren't aware of Gorton.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
Right. So this is what she says. Gorton's the kind of place makes a person feel lucky to come from Moss Side. Or from anywhere, really, seeing how Gorton's a grade A shithole. Five-lane carriageway, abandoned shops, grim little terraces standing on the sidelines weeping in the rain. Every so often there's a patch of scrub and rubble in between the houses where they knocked something down and forgot to put anything back. No grass anywhere, not even any gardens. This is where Myra Hindley grew up with her nan, and that's no surprise to anyone, not when you think about it. Round here people remember places by the murders, and we got way more than our share of those. East Manchester reads like a Brady and Hindley travel guide, and Harold Shipman put that other shithole hide on the map single-handed. Seems as if everybody knows somebody who knew someone who knew one of those bastards, and Keith Bennett's man Winnie, must be 70-odd now, still follows that road to the moors every week like she has for 40 years, searching, pinning thin bunches of flowers to fence posts in the wind. Every couple of years there's a dig for Keith, and thousands turn out. Carla bought us both a new spade for the last one. Out there digging all night, only a twix between us till the fog came down so thick that no one could see a hand in front of their face anymore. Gave me a proper eerie feeling, I can tell you. No one found anything, they never do. And last time old Winnie was on Granada Reports, you had to wonder how someone could carry all that pain and still be standing. Gorton, Droylsden, Ashton, Stalybridge, Hattersley, Hyde, our places are dark. We're loyal and fierce, but if you come from around here, there's a stain, a sort of shame that clings onto you that you just can't wash out, can make you go all savage. You have to know it. You have to know us to get it. We're Manx when all said and done, so we should hang on to that stuff, even stuff that no one in their right mind should want, just because we get so much taken away. And that, I know you want to talk about the next bit, so I'm going to let you do that. But couple of things about that. One, it made me think of Caleb Femi's poetry collection, Paul, which came out last year, which is all about how the place that he grew up in, which is a council estate in, I can't remember which bit of London, but is very like concrete, affects the way that people behave. I mean, there's been loads written about this if you go looking for it, the way that your environment affects you as a person. And I think she's really nailed that here. And also the stuff about Winnie Bennett, like obviously they've been searching for his remains again recently. Winnie died not knowing where he is. So there's also the sort of tragedy of that. And the bit there about Carla and Donna, and what you were saying about loyalty before as well, about the fact it doesn't matter that they're gang running and they're part of this, you know, massive thing. They understand what it was like for her to lose that child, for somebody to murder it, and they're out there like looking for him with everybody else. So it said something like really important about the characters as well, I thought. So yeah, there were bits of this that were bonkers and bits of this where she just nailed what it's like to grow up in poverty and the cycles of trauma and how people relate to each other when they grow up in that sort of place.
Yeah, and I think that's particularly made clear by two things, one of which is the thing that you just referenced, I'm going to talk about in a minute. which is that second, I'm actually just going to carry on from where you left off, where you said, we're Manx when all said and done, so we hang on to stuff, even stuff that no one in the right mind should want, just because we get so much taken away. And that's how someone came down, that's how someone down south can make a picture of Myra made up of Baba's hands, hang it up in a Tate and call it art. If it was just a thing that happened, as if it was just a thing that happened way back, as if poor Winnie Johnson didn't even exist, put that up in the Whitworth and he'd have been hanging up right alongside it before you could say jack shit. And that, along with the character Sanjay, who is the father of Aurora's best friend from school, Geet. So after Carla is killed, at first, for a short amount of time, days, Aurora goes to stay at Geet's house, and they are middle class. You know, she takes, at the beginning of the book, there are a few chapters that are narrated by Aurora, and she basically says, God, it sounds awful, like she has to sit down with her parents and do stuff, and then they ask her, they take an interest in her life, she gets no time to herself, it sounds absolutely horrendous. Which is really funny. But they have the you know, the Sanjay, the father, obviously feels very protective towards Aurora and wants to do the right thing, and realizes, because they went to the funeral and they saw how drunk Marie, who's Aurora's grandmother, was, they realize that she's living in chaos and poverty, and that she is living, you know, she's taking care of this alcoholic woman. And so they do what all right thinking nice middle class people do, which is they tell the authorities. They tell the school, they get the social in, and very quickly Aurora is taken into care. And it's the kind of naivety of people who have never had to be in any way proximate to the care system to assume that they will take care of her, that she will be safe, that she will be protected, that she's going to go to a lovely home and be well looked after, and everything's going to be wonderful. And of course Aurora knows, as do Donna and the rest of the gang, as soon as they find out from their various contacts that Aurora has been taken into care, they know that this is the worst possible thing could happen. They are all products of the care system. That's how they've ended up where they've ended up. It is cycles and cycles of trauma. And for them, Aurora ending up in care is almost a fate worse than death. So that, along with this idea of this sort of Southern artist taking Myra Hindley as if she's this sort of almost unreal person, and fating her with a huge portrait in the Tate, even if that wasn't his intention, and this was a real thing that happened, I remember it being on the news, it takes something that community felt great ownership of and a great deal of protection towards people like Winnie and the families and the children, and made a spectacle of it, literally made a spectacle of it. And yes, it's the only thing, it's the kind of thing that could only happen in London or a long way away from that community. If it had happened in it wouldn't have happened in the Whitworth. It just wouldn't have, ever, you know. And I thought that, again, for all the madness and the machine guns and the secret boats across the channel, that's a bit later, and all this sort of madcap stuff, the way that it deals with class and the failures of the system and cycles of trauma is very, very, very well done.
Yeah, and I can't remember whether I've said this on here. I'm going to put the cat among the pigeons possibly at this point. I know I've said it to you before, but my whole thing with working class people being able to tell their own stories is that when middle class people write them, and this is 99.9% of the time, sorry, middle class writers, they get it fucking wrong, so fucking wrong, and it drives me mad. So there's something about, for me, reading a book that's written by somebody who is working class and understands what's happened. So like you said, yeah, all the drama stuff is great and entertaining, and that, but that understanding of it like made it a better book for me. Like, I think I enjoyed it so much because of that you got the light and shade of it all. I just wanted to read as well the bit, because this prophet, there are bits in it that are really very funny. There's a bit when, so Aurora's been taken into care and Donna's found out, she's just found out, they've just told her that they've got her. And she says, "We need more people in the system, higher up, not just wiping arses in Resi. It's not like you can just pay someone for information anymore. Not safe enough. Needs to be tight. You want someone to shovel shit for you these days. You can't afford for them to bring their own spade. We need the money to train them," she says. "Maybe if Jess comes through this time, we could think about it. But right now, I can't think of anyone I hate enough to send on a social work course. So I drop it." And I thought that just said everything about, and I've got friends who are social workers, but, you know, they tell me all sorts of horrendous things about the way that the system's running at the minute. And yeah, the fact that she doesn't even want, she can't think of anyone that she hates enough to be on that side of the system, says it all, really.
Yeah. I've got a couple of lines that I've wrote down just because I thought they were really funny. One's from really close to the beginning, where one of the characters' son says, "You want to lose those stripes for some sugar, baby girl? That going to be hard candy, girlfriend. I kid you not," she says. Now we're all smiling. I swear, ever since she got Sky Plus, she's been talking like that. And the other bit, which is from one of Aurora's chapters, where she's talking about her dad, who's in prison, is in Glasgow, some place called the Bar L. Mam says it's like Strange Ways, only worse because it's full of Scottish. That's the Glaswegian.
Because the author's also Scottish, isn't she? But she went to live in Manchester. Manchester. So yeah, it did make me laugh when I read that line, because it made me think of you reading it. one of the bits that really made me laugh was when Donna goes to see where Carla's going to be buried to check it out. And the grave diggers tell her that they can't dig the grave the night before because it rains that fucking much in Manchester that it'd be full of water by the next day. And I'm like, that's the most Manchester thing I've ever read. It's brilliant. The other thing that really made me laugh as well is there is a character in it called Father Tom, who's an actual priest, vicar, don't know what, I can't remember which religion. Does it ever say which religion he is? I don't know if it does.
It says he's a priest because Donna asks him about being celibate.
Ah, yeah, she does, you're right. So he's really quite supportive of it. He helps Donna out, and he knows what's going on, but he's like, you know, quite nice.
Turns the other cheek.
Yes, yeah. He's quite a sort of, I was going to say old-fashioned. I suppose I mean old-fashioned in the way that he accepts anybody, which is like what people are supposed to do, in it. Anyway, but it means that when when Aurora's escaped from the people who've got her, and she ends up rocking up at a police station, and she's trying to explain, she won't talk to him. And so the person she asked for, because she doesn't want to get anybody else in the shit, his Father Tom, and they automatically assume that he's molested her. And that shouldn't be funny, because police molesting kids are not funny, but it's just the way that they properly like are straight on it, and have got her in the, like, family room trying to get her to say what's happened. And it's just so, because we know Father Tom's a character by that point, it's really funny. And she doesn't understand what's going on, so that just makes it even funnier. Oh dear.
There's also a really funny bit, which I won't explain because it would give the plot away, but there is a scene, and I won't explain why, but they're out in the hills. A large dramatic thing is about to go down. And as backup, they've basically, through the various grapevines, roped in every lesbian gang they know as far away as Scotland. And they all flash their torches, and it's just like the hill lights up with all these flashes of different, it's just like lesbians in the hills everywhere. There's the Liverpudlian ones, there's the ones from Scotland, there's these ones and that one. And they're all, like, they're all hiding out there ready to back Donna up.
I did thoroughly enjoy the idea of lesbian gangs, like, running around. Yeah.
Much scarier than the men. Much tougher.
Well, the like... The sort of key scene for me with the men, early on, they go to see Tony, who's like the big honcho, And he fucking phones his mum next door to bring some biscuits round.
Yeah.
Which tells you all you need to know about how fucking, you know, big and whatever he is.
Yeah, absolutely.
See, two books about that have got... what is it with us picking books for terrible men in? There's a theme here, Kirsty.
There really is, yeah. Yeah, speaking of terrible men, next week...
Are there more terrible men?
More terrible men. Yeah, next week we're talking about two South American... Oh, no, one of them is Mexican, so Central and South American novels. One is Slum Virgin, which is by Gabriela Gabazon Camara, which and translated by Francis Riddle, who I think translated another book that we read. I remember her name and I can't remember. I think it was a Fitzcarraldo one. Anyway, that's published by Charco Press. And then the other one is Mexican Gothic by Silvia Marino Garcia. Is it Garcia? Yes, it is Garcia, which is something I've been waiting to read for ages. So, I am indeed late to it. So, expect more terrible men next week.
We've been warned.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. You also, by the time this goes out, may or may not be able to follow us on Twitter because Elon Musk's taken over and who knows what's going to have happened by then. If we're still on Twitter, Kirsty's at The Other Kirsty and I'm at Naomi Frisbee. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.